Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is paleo artist John Gerchy. Gerchy studied anthropology and paleontology at the University of Kansas. His award-winning work has been featured in National Geographic, Discover, and Natural History magazines, and on display at the American Museum of Natural History in New York and the Field Museum in Chicago. Over the past year, he has been artist-in-residence at Ithaca's Museum of the Earth, creating his Sculpting Human History exhibit, which is now destined for permanent display at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, D.C. Welcome to the show, John.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, I want to talk about your beginnings. You were interested in skeletons and fossils as a child and did a lot of backyard exploring and discovery. Tell us what it was that pulled you toward that.
I'm not sure I can say because it was so young that I started, but there was something about the intricacy of the forms that I was seeing. Like I remember the first fossil that I was aware was a fossil was a tiny, tiny little brachiopod, only a few millimeters across, and it had these precise little lines in it. And I was just fascinated that could occur in a rock. That sort of organization.
Uh-huh. So, some kids are afraid of skeletons because they think of them as death.
Yeah.
But you found some kind of life in them.
Well, there might have been some Halloween mixed in there, too, at the beginning. But that was a positive thing for me.
But to tell us also, I also understand that you were influenced by the film 2001, A Space Odyssey, and that sort of took you on your course through where we find you now.
Right.
Tell us, why did that influence you?
Well, I think a lot of people have taken inspiration from that movie. Some of them had to become astronomers, some of them had to become filmmakers. For me, it was that I knew that I had to do art, and I also knew I had to do something about human origins, because I'd studied evolution when I was a kid, and in fact I had this big project of trying to make this gigantic wall chart of the evolution of all of life, and of course I didn't complete that ever, but anyway, I got to a point where I kind of put that aside for teenage things, and I was in a band for a while and that sort of thing. And it all kind of came crashing back when I went to see 2001, A Space Odyssey, in, I think it was spring of 69, because the film so eloquently expresses the enormity of the journey that we're on. I mean, just the scene from the bone weapon going up in the air to the orbiting spacecraft, if you are tuned into that, it's enough to just blow your mind. And so I realized that what I was seeing on film was a jump in evolution, and that I was getting a view of the next step, you know. So I saw the 4 million years ago proto-hominids, and then I saw present-day humans, and then I got to see what happens next. And it was just such an enormous journey that we're all really part of. So that was so inspiring to me that I had to... Luckily, I hadn't found a job that summer, and my parents probably thought I was a bum, and I wandered around barefoot and tossed a bone up in the air. But I also was doing a lot of thinking that led me to what I did later, and I started my first evolution mural, and I started reading all about human origins, and, you know, that's where it really started for me.
I think that's really interesting that a movie about space and the future would take you back into the past.
Well, it's because of the connection with the past in the film. I mean, it starts 4 million years ago, comes up to today, and then just shows you the next stage. And for me to picture that we are on such a continuum, and really, when you think about it, any sort of projection of where we are now into the future based on where we've been is at least as fantastic as 2001, A Space Odyssey, if we survive, and that's a big if.
Yeah, that is a big if right now. Now do you think you would have stayed in the field of paleontology and anthropology if you hadn't been able to converge it with your art?
Yeah, probably so. It was a tough choice as it was, deciding between that and doing the art. When I was in graduate school, I had gotten a master's, was going on for a PhD, and I had taken over one of my advisor's courses. And the Smithsonian asked me to bid on a project, and so it became really clear to me what I wanted to do, and I packed up my little Volkswagen and moved to D.C. and started doing what I do now, starving at first.
Of course. Yeah. Isn't that what's supposed to happen? Starving artists. Now, you began doing what you have called paleo art full-time beginning in 1980. Well, what was your first major project?
The first one was really for the Smithsonian. It was a mural that was to back up a foreground, so it was kind of a diorama. the extension, the back mural of a diorama. And I had to match the foreground with the background, and I figured out all this complex perspective and stuff that I really didn't have to do, but I took the job so seriously. Uh-huh. And
What was the subject?
I'm sorry?
What was the subject?
The subject was the transition to land. It was a little hall that's just off the dinosaur hall there. And so I did a painting that had both Eusthenopteron, which is a lobe-finned fish, and Ichthyostega, which is a really early amphibian. I didn't really get to design the painting myself, so which was kind of interesting, you know, not being able to do that and having to work on somebody else's design. But I made it mine as much as I could with the lighting and the, you know, the forms and all that.
Yeah, well, that brings me to my next question. Do you envision a whole picture before you start painting it? I mean, the background, and do you do research on?
Yeah, a lot of times I do. I know enough, just enough to be dangerous about most paleo topics, and so I can actually kind of, you know, go back in time mentally and stop a scene or rotate around it for, you know, walk around it for a good angle, get close to two fighting dinosaurs while they're stopped in action. And that's usually how it starts.
Huh.
I suppose if I knew less about paleo stuff, I probably would do a lot of reading and hopefully something would come to mind during all that.
Uh-huh. So when you say you go back visually, are you visualizing somebody else's depiction that you saw as a child? How did that come about?
That's a good question. I'm not sure where I'm getting these, but they're not. They're most of the time not like what I saw as a child, and I don't know why that is. But for example, well, when I was working on dinosaurs more, I did a lot of stuff from a low angle, as you would be if you were standing very close to dinosaurs.
Uh-huh.
And not too many people worked that way. To me, it was the obvious, it was the thing you see if you go back in time.
So you'd be looking up.
That's right. So I don't know where that came from.
Really? So it really is a vision then?
Maybe. And somehow I can make it real to me, and that's an important thing, especially if you want to convince other people that it's real. Maybe I have to credit, you know, old dinosaur movies and Ray Harryhausen's stop action animation and all that stuff, you know, for making it all the way real to me.
Yeah, that has to be in all of our imaginations. It's hard to think of a fresh view away from some of those images that we got in childhood, especially the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Dino the dinosaur. Now, you never formally studied art. Do you think that's given you a freedom to you know, convey things that you wouldn't if you had been told there's certain disciplines that you have to follow?
Yeah, I think so. I'm really grateful to my parents for not signing me up for lessons every time I showed an interest in anything, because I was a kid who did better, you know, sort of exploring it on his own, even if it was learning the hard way, I think.
Uh-huh. But you never felt the need to study?
No. If I wanted to learn something, I would just experiment and see if I could get it right. Sometimes with disastrous results.
Yeah, well, I think all artists go through those things. Were you influenced by Da Vinci in some of the early drawings?
Well, I wasn't early on. I wasn't, but I love the drawings of the Renaissance and those guys in particular, Leonardo and Michelangelo and Dürer, and the paintings themselves, it's funny, they don't really affect me as strongly. They're like completely finished facades. What I want to see is what's going on behind the facade, and that's what you see in the drawings. You see sort of thinking on paper, so uh-huh. I love that.
And the creation of something.
And a lot of times you can see designs that didn't quite work out, you know, on the edges of the paper and that sort of thing.
Uh-huh. And do you do the same things? I mean, do you start drawing? And
yeah, I do. Mine don't look as good.
Now, wait a minute. Maybe they do. Leonardo wasn't drawing dinosaurs.
That's true. But, you know, it's interesting to speculate on what he would do if he were alive today. I always think he would be drawn to paleo stuff, and especially human origins.
Why do you think that? Because he was interested in anatomy,
yeah,
for
he's
sure.
So interested in the human form and what the elements are. I think he would have been interested also in the evolution of the human form and how it got that way.
Wow, that's an interesting thing to imagine. Now, you did your first reconstruction in 1984. It was a Neanderthal. That's how you pronounce it, right?
That's right.
A lot of people say Neanderthal, right?
Yeah, it's just, yeah.
Well, what kind of detail went into that, the first thing that you rendered?
I wanted it to be extremely lifelike. And so I had to kind of make my own method because I didn't like any of the methods that I saw in existence. They weren't, I wanted to try to aim a little higher than that if I could. There are now, but there weren't at the time. And so I sort of cobbled together a method based on, I talked to a lot of the people in Hollywood, makeup artists and so forth, about how you do things, and sort of got this method together. And for the scientific end of it, since I was working with the Neanderthal, it's so close to being a modern person, it's so such a close relative, that mm-hmm. you can get away with using some modern data, like you can't for things earlier than that. So that was an interesting process, and I did a lot of human dissection. And I hadn't done much in the way of great ape dissection yet, and I had to do a lot of that before I began to understand how the face is put together in that whole group, including humans and African apes. And that's when I could go further back in time. But the first one was a Neanderthal, mostly because it was like sticking your toe in the water. You know, it's close enough to modern that you can use a lot of modern information. It still comes out looking very distinctive. But yeah. But it does look like a person. Uh-huh. You wouldn't say it's not a person.
Yeah, and a lot of things prior probably to what you were doing, the depictions looked ape-like, much more ape-like.
Well, I can't take credit for initiating that. In fact, Jay Maternus probably was the first to really do that, make them a lot more human. If you really use good data, they don't come up with much of a brutish appearance. They look like a little odd-looking humans, basically, with big faces, large brow ridges, no chin, but still human.
Uh-huh. And are you able to do that? Because we have, through the years and through the decades, found more fossils and been able to actually put stuff together.
It's partly that, and it's also that the science kind of went through a renovation. Early on, the big study that was published between the years of 1911 and 1913 by a French scientist, he was basically saying the state of the art as far as our knowledge of Neanderthals, and he looked at a lot of different specimens, but he based a lot of his findings on one skeleton, and it turned out to be a pathological skeleton, and he didn't catch that. And so that made him think that Neanderthals had habitually a bent-kneed, bent-hipped stature with a head thrown forward.
Oh.
And really, all of that was because of pathology. They're as upright as we are. Their posture is as modern as ours. So,
this was a skeleton that had disease.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, I had never heard that. That's fascinating.
Yeah, it's kind of spawned that brutish caveman image, and it's a hard image for Neanderthals to shake. Poor Neanderthals.
Now, how much has the computer world and the high-tech world changed the way you study and decide? And
Imaging has changed a lot, and that helps because it's much easier to gather data on living organisms, whether it's a human or a chimpanzee or whatever. So that's probably the thing that's influenced me the most. I keep waiting for the perfect computer-generated reconstruction to be possible, but the ones I've seen so far don't quite match up to what you can actually do in real space with clay. So
really?
I'm waiting for that to catch up.
Oh, that's surprising.
Yeah, it is kind of surprising.
Huh. Now, well, how much guesswork really does go into deciding how these people looked and walked and stood? And
well, you try to use all the scientific information you can gather, and it turns out there are quite a few useful relationships in anatomical relationships in chimpanzees and humans and gorillas. And if you can find those, for example, rules by which the face is constructed, relationships between bony dimensions and soft tissue dimensions, or maybe body weight with soft tissue, which would allow you to predict those things for something you only had a fossil of and that you had never seen alive. So you take that as far as you can. Some areas of the face are a lot easier than others. The area of the eyes and above, you can reconstruct those with almost certainty. the lower face, there are some areas that you have to sort of build some extrapolation. For example, humans have malar fat pads in the cheeks that there's nothing comparable in an African ape face. And so it looks suspiciously like something that was added to enhance communication value, because the lines that form when we smile, the lines on either side of our nose and mouth, those form because that fat pad has a very sharp edge. It has a truncated edge. So it looks like the smile lines are because of the malar fat pads, which were added sometime after the chimp-human split. So then you have to go into communication and think about, you know, read up on the origin of language and try to figure out how sophisticated communication might have been at that time in order to make an educated guess about when the timing of that addition was. So that gives you an example of some of the more speculative stuff. Mm-hmm.
If you're just joining us, my guest is paleo artist John Gurchy. Now, I want to talk to you about the dinosaurs that you've depicted through the years. How do you decide the colors?
Well, basically, I make them up.
Really?
I mean, it's a pretty good guess that dinosaurs as a group were using color, because their modern relatives do, birds and reptiles. Mammals are not famous for their color vision, except for a few exceptions like primates, but birds and reptiles have very good color vision and often have display, you know, behavior and sometimes anatomy. And there are a number of anatomical structures on dinosaurs that don't really look like they have any other function than display. So it'd be really surprising if they weren't using color in some way. Beyond that, you know, it's a matter of aesthetics. I know people who like to do them purple and orange, and I don't quite go that far.
Are you talking about Barney?
No, I'm not. No, I'm talking about people who are trying to paint a realistic scene but are using these outrageous colors. We don't know.
Yeah. So everybody is just up for grabs.
Yeah.
Huh. Wow. Now, why do you think we humans still want to continue to reconnect with the past? Continuously? With fossils and depictions and movies?
Why do we want to?
Yeah.
Well, I think everybody is interested in the larger story that humans are part of, including where we came from, and it probably helps to understand that before we can even have a clue about where we're heading. It's nice to understand some of our behavior based on where we've been, and a lot of behavioral studies of apes have helped with that. It's nice to be able to piece together our evolution, and it's fascinating to hold the skull of a 2-million-year-old or a 4-million-year-old ancestor in your hand. And I don't think anybody's completely immune from that.
Uh-huh. Do you find it a spiritual experience?
Depending on what you mean by spiritual, it's a very moving experience, and it's a very poetic experience. And I've had moments where, well, traveling to South Africa, for example, to look at a new skeleton, you know, they take it out of the vault and put it on the table in its special box, and you're taking it out carefully and laying it on the table, and you're there to collect information about it. You're there to make measurements and that sort of thing. But first, you have to just respond to the enormity of the whole thing. It's just an amazing thing to view this skeleton laid out, this 2.5-million-year-old skeleton. So myself, I can't completely shut that out. I mean, you need to keep it in check to some degree and not hyperventilate while you're taking measurements. But, you know, it's hard to escape the poetry of that. And who'd want to?
Yeah, I can imagine. Well, that's what I love about natural history museums, the bones and skeletons.
Right.
You start putting your own imagination into what their lives were like. Now you worked on a project called Lost Anatomies, illustrating anatomical changes that have happened throughout our evolution. Tell us some of those.
Tell us some
of the changes that we can identify.
Right. Well, there's some new fossils found that I can't tell you very much about.
Really?
Watch for an announcement of something mind-blowing from South Africa, but they're fossils that I think are going to help a lot with that question. But the basic outline of it goes something like this. We don't know what happened soon after the split with chimpanzees, because that happened around 6 or 6.5 million years ago, and we only have fragments from that time period. So we're not really sure. The first complete skeleton, not complete skeletons, but partial skeletons that we have are a good bit later. Lucy's, for example, is 3.2 million, and there's one that's about to be announced that's 4.4 million. That hopefully will show us something about what came before Lucy, because the interesting thing about Lucy's kind, her skeleton looks like an ape's that has been modified for walking on two legs. Mm-hmm. And that's, otherwise she's very ape-like. And so that's the first sort of anatomical revision that happened, you know, and it includes things, you know, the spine being curved differently to balance the weight. The pelvis has to be very different, and the musculature, muscle attachments have to be positioned differently for us to walk bipedally, and up and down the legs and the feet, a lot of changes. We see most of those in Lucy and her kind. So mm-hmm. it's interesting. We don't really have a good idea of how those came to be. In other words, they can't have, you know, some of them had presumably had to precede others, and we don't know what happened first. And
there's
we don't
some missing.
Yeah, that's
missing
right. And we don't exactly know why it happened either. We're not sure why we became bipedal, but that's basically the first wave of anatomical revisions. And then later things had to do with definitely the development of the brain, the shift to a meat-eating diet, the reduction of the face as teeth didn't have to be quite as large, a shortening of the forearm, probably something to do with throwing. So that's what Lost Anatomies is, basically a chronicle of all those, and I'll be publishing that hopefully next year in 2010.
Really? You're going to publish it in book form?
Yeah.
Oh, fascinating. Now, to tell us about the project that you've been working on at the Museum of the Earth, Sculpting Human History exhibit, right?
Right.
Tell us about that.
Well, it's basically a Smithsonian project, and I can't tell you details there until they announce what it's all about, but they're being made for public display at the Smithsonian. They'll be bronzes. I worked hard with the Smithsonian team to decide, if you're going to do five bronzes to represent the sweep of human history, which five and what should they be doing?
Oh, yeah.
So there was a lot of thought that went into that. And I've been working on it for something like a year and 2 months. I've finished all the adults. I'm working on a Neanderthal toddler right now, and that's turning out interestingly. But anyway, the project was for the Smithsonian from the beginning, but I thought it might be nice for the Museum of the Earth visitors to be able to watch the process from beginning to end. Mm-hmm. So at first all you could see were armatures, and I was attaching bones one by one. I was making a skeleton for each of them, and this is all based on the fossil casts that I have and proportions shown by fossil skeletons and that sort of thing. So that's it in a nutshell. The species involved are Australopithecus boisei, Homo erectus, Homo heidelbergensis, which may be an archaic form of Homo sapiens. There's a Neanderthal mother and child, and there's Homo floresiensis, the weird little hobbit that was found on the island of Flores in Indonesia.
Wow, the little hobbit. That's a fascinating find, wasn't it?
Oh my God, that's a very interesting twig on the human tree. It's going to be really interesting to follow that as it's studied further, but it's a mind blower, and it has.
We don't know where to place it, right?
We don't really know where to place it. At first, the thought was that it was a dwarfed form of Homo erectus, and part of that was because Homo erectus was widely seen to be the first hominid out of Africa. In fact, it's the first one that's known out of Africa, and part of it also is that we could tell this was an archaic hominid that had been dwarfed, but it had a very small brain. And once they started studying the hand and the foot and other areas of the body, it begins to look like it's more primitive than Homo erectus, which is amazing because it's difficult to imagine more primitive forms, earlier forms, getting out of Africa, and how they would make the water crossing to Flores, I think, just has scientists throwing up their hands, because almost any scenario you come up with for that sounds very unlikely. If I tell you that there were a bunch of them that were foraging on the ground and in trees, and a big chunk of the bank fell off into the ocean, and this raft of trees and vegetation floated over to Flores, would you consider that likely? That's one of the most likely scenarios they've come up with.
It seems unbelievable, doesn't it? Wow. Now, let's talk a little bit about the fact that you did pre-production work for Steven Spielberg's Jurassic Park. What was that like? Trying to make those things actually come to life and move.
It was great fun. I got that assignment in the summer of 1990, and I worked on the Tyrannosaurus segment. And at first I thought they wanted pretty dry stuff. You know, I thought they just wanted anatomy and maybe ranges of motion for joints and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I did all that, and then they came back to me and said, for this next segment, I want you to do more. I want you to dream up plot elements, think about the animal almost as a character. And that was working on the Velociraptor segments. And I've always viewed Velociraptor as sort of a nasty-smelling chicken with a switchblade. That would be my...
Do they fly? I'm not exactly sure what they are.
No, they're feathered, probably. It looks like they're feathered, but that was before flight feathers evolved.
Huh.
Well, it wasn't actually before, because the first birds had already originated, but this was another branch of the tree, and they didn't develop flight feathers.
Uh-huh. So you actually got to build characters.
Yeah, I got to think about him a little bit as a character. And as I said, I had this strong sort of preconception about what it would be like to see one in a cage or see one alive. And it was fall by that time. It was October. It was getting near Halloween. And I was working a lot of nights working on this. And my office was at the Smithsonian at the time. It's a very shadowy and spooky place at night. So it was really conducive to kind of coming up with these images of a shadowy place where velociraptors were maybe trying to get in and humans were, trapped. That sort of thing.
And
so I did a lot of drawings of that sort of thing.
And how did you like the final product? Was it to your expectations?
I liked it a lot in lots of ways. I think it made dinosaurs real for people mm-hmm. for the first time to a degree they never had before. Been. It's not exactly a deep movie.
No, it's not.
I could never say that it was my favorite movie or anything like that, but it was fun to see the dinosaurs on screen in such a realistic way.
Yeah, I think that really shocked a lot of people. They did seem very realistic.
Yeah.
The first time.
That really is the first time. In fact, they had hired a more traditional animator to work on the dinosaurs using something called Go Motion, which is a descendant of stop motion that Harryhausen and company used. Apparently that guy was already on board, and a couple of sort of renegade computer people started doing this thing where they made these wireframe skeletons run over a hill, and when they showed that to people, it blew everyone's socks off, and then they actually clothed it in flesh and made them, you know, more real, and the animator declared himself extinct. And I think they kept him on as an animal motion expert, but mm-hmm. his method of doing it, the animation was right in mid-movie, was suddenly obsolete.
Uh-huh. Well, we only have a couple minutes left.
Sure.
Do you still have a child's wonder about all these things, dinosaurs? And
I have a lot of wonder about it. Yeah, I don't know if it's childlike or adult-like, but I love this stuff, and with dinosaurs, it's more of a sort of an exotic vacation for me to go to the Mesozoic and see all these bizarre life forms that are very different from us. But to me, it has a lot more impact to study human evolution because it's us. It's the journey that we're all on, and finding out about that is great.
Uh-huh. Well, John Gerchy, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure, glad to
and
be
we,
here.
And we wish you well on your future projects. Can't wait.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.